tomorrow night. Like, oh. Okay.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I was
recorded
so excited about
live.
It. I forgot we're in Jeremiah. All right, thanks for reminding me. Okay. Which means I'm totally unprepared. Right. Okay, let me turn my Bible to Jeremiah. And what chapter were we on?
We're on Jeremiah chapter 13. If you introduce the show, I have a paragraph.
Yes.
Review
okay.
of last
yes.
week.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And excuse my interruption here and false start because I was getting ready to talk about Revelation. I forgot tonight's show is about Jeremiah. So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here along with William Fink. And tonight we're going to continue our study on the book of Jeremiah. And we're going to be proceeding right into chapter 13. So, Bill, do you have any summary of chapters up to this point?
Well, yeah, just a quick one from Jeremiah 9, which we covered last week, right, from 9 through 12. Jeremiah's indictment against the remnant of Judah continues to unfold. Last week from Jeremiah 9, we saw that Yahweh depicted himself as a man wronged by a sinful wife, the nation of Israel, because that nation forsook the law.
Right.
Yahweh has promised to bring a nation through trials of fire in order to refine it. The people are accused in chapter 9 of following after the imagination of their own heart and after Baalim, which certainly also describes our people today, right?
That's right.
And that's why they're going in 230 million different directions, right? Just as our ancient ancestors followed the ways after the ways of Canaan, we're doing the same thing now. I mean, all this New Age paganism and all this garbage, it's all the ways of Canaan. None of it's new. It's all New Age is it is the old Kenite Age. It's repeated. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews have resurrected the ancient Canaanite earth religions and Baal religions and setting them up with different names, and people follow after them today. We then see that the promise that Yahweh would scatter his people among the nations, not among the heathen, but the Genesis 10 Adamic nations where they were taken.
Mm-hmm.
And that promise was already fulfilled of all Israel in general, and now it's being promised of this last remnant of Judah. There's nothing enigmatic about this. The Jews try to say, oh, this happened to them, that happened to them. The books of Kings and Chronicles, and in part the prophecies of Ezekiel and others, and especially Isaiah, they give us plenty of clues as to where these people were taken and where they went, and they could certainly be traced in history, right?
Mm-hmm.
We
yeah.
then see in Jeremiah chapter 10 another indictment of paganism, which includes, and it perfectly describes, our own Christmas festival practices,
right.
such as setting up trees in our homes and decorating them with silver and gold.
Right.
Jeremiah equates these things directly to idolatry. No matter how harmless we think them to be, oh, it's for the children, oh, it's only for 2 weeks, it's this, it's that, it's idolatry. There's no way around that. If you want to engage in it, don't whitewash it. It's idolatry.
Yeah.
And it's that simple.
Yeah.
Let me
interject right here that the fact is that much of the current paganism in white nations directly comes from the pagan experience of our ancestors in the 10 northern tribes.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's not New Age. You know, the Christmas festivals aren't New Age. Our people brought those traditions with them out of Mesopotamia
mm-hmm.
when they dispersed through the Caucasus and around the Black Sea and into Europe.
Right.
There's no doubt. And we see the Christmas festival and the holiday, you know, the idols associated with that holiday expressed and described very well in Jeremiah chapter 10. I don't know how anybody could get around that without
right.
a whole lot of subterfuge. And in Jeremiah chapter 11, Yahweh invokes the curses pronounced upon those who break his covenants. And he's referring to Exodus chapter 19, of course, but also the specific blessings and curses that came along with the promises made to and by our fathers, which are enumerated in the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And I think it's Deuteronomy 28 specifically, yeah, you know, and Leviticus also, but Deuteronomy 28 specifically lists a set of blessings of obedience and curses of disobedience. If you look at those curses of disobedience, they all happened in ancient Israel. And they all are happening here and in Europe today.
Right.
And they include our nations being overrun by heathens, by non Adamic peoples by racial aliens and taken over by them.
Right.
Yahweh appeals to the people and gives them an opportunity to repent. And I believe that that shows us that there is always such an opportunity, but the people do not listen to the prophet. And therefore, the theme turns to the fact that sinners have no recourse. Only the repentant have access to Yahweh through prayer. And we also see that the statement here that the holy flesh is passed from thee, it is very much like we saw in Jeremiah chapter 2, a clear statement concerning race mixing. Jeremiah then describes the hate which our people have for those who make manifest these sins. And we see that today. When you point out race mixing to race mixers, or you point out homosexuality that is evil, and the people hate you. Even when they're not race mixers or homosexuals, they hate you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very sinful, the entire attitude of our world today is caught up in these same sins that Jerusalem was caught up in before Yahweh judged Jerusalem.
Right.
How do we expect to escape the judgment of God?
Pretend the law doesn't exist. That's how we do it.
Well, right. Pretend the law doesn't exist, and in most cases, even Christians, they pretend that Christ is a whole entirely different God. That he's not in any way at all associated with that mean Old Testament God that had those cruel laws.
They even tell us he's a Jew.
Well, right. Jeremiah 12 is, again, a plea by Yahweh for Israel. And as our New Testament prophets, apostles professed, all of these things were recorded for our example. And yet our people still don't heed them.
Right.
It's so clear to read this and to see it all in society today, and even Christians who read the Old Testament don't see these parallels.
Right.
And on the day of their judgment, we've had these writings and claimed this Bible for how many hundreds of years now.
Yeah.
On the day of judgment, how could they have an excuse?
Right. Well, it's ironic because Paul clearly says that the scriptures are, you know, good for instruction, and yet the New Testament Christians say, well, we'll just throw that whole old book away. It's no good to us, right? We can't use that. So it's hypocritical. It's totally hypocritical. And, we could probably list hundreds of correlations between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And, you can't really understand the New Testament at all. Okay, without instruction in the Old Testament. But before we get actually into the discussion of Jeremiah 13, I have a couple of quick announcements. First of all, New Nations News, or New Nation News, which is it's a website that publishes black on white crime. Okay, it has all kinds of articles on blacks committing murder and rape, et cetera, against white people. And they have just posted a link to my website, www.anglo-saxonisrael.com. There's a lot of white nationalists, obviously, and neo-pagans. And it looks like they're opening up the Christian identity, which is very good. Okay. And then Wednesday night when I was on the Rick Adams show, I was, my subject was covenant theology. And I basically quoted the Old Testament scriptures that show that the covenants were made exclusively with the Israelites of the Bible, and that seed line from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I was, in fact, I got a couple of complaints that Eli, you talked too much about two seed line. Well, that was Rick Adams' fault. He wanted to talk about two seed line. I was never even going to bring it up. I was just going to talk about the covenants. And so it's good news that Rick Adams is just, accepting the two seed line truth, and now has no objection to it whatsoever on Republic Broadcasting Network. Obviously, the other broadcasters on that network aren't quite with us yet, but we'll get there. We'll get there, okay?
Well, there are people like Michael Collins Piper that are on Republic, aren't they?
Yeah.
He's never going to accept two seed line.
No.
He's got his lips wrapped around the average Arab's beat derriere. He'll never accept it.
No,
he's in bed with Mark Glenn,
right,
and people like that.
Yes. Yes. So it's a good thing we have at least one advocate at Republic Broadcasting Network. That's really good. Okay. All right. Shall we get into Jeremiah 13?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Verse 1. Thus says Yahweh to me, go and get you a linen girdle and put it upon your loins and put it not in water. So I got a girdle according to the word of Yahweh and put it on my loins. And the word of Yahweh came to me the second time, saying, take the girdle that you have got, which is upon your loins, and arise, go to Euphrates, and hide it there in a hole of a sock. So I went there.
Of the rock.
So I went, I was thinking of sock puppets. So I went and hid it by Euphrates, as Yahweh commanded me. And it came to pass after many days that Yahweh said to me, arise, go to Euphrates, and take the girdle from there which I commanded you to hide there. Then I went to Euphrates and dug and took the girdle from the place where I had hidden it, and behold, the girdle was marred. It was profitable for nothing.
Now this girdle is really the it's the undergarment, right? It's the equivalent of our boxer shorts.
Okay.
It's Jeremiah's own undergarment.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Then the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, thus says Yahweh, after this manner will I mar the pride of Judah. I will soil their pants. In other words, he's saying, right?
And, well, right. That's what he's saying.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. And the great pride of Jerusalem. This evil people, which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girdle, which is good for nothing.
Rotten underwear.
Yeah, right. And hanging out the dirty laundry, right? But it's not even worth hanging out. For as the girdle clings to the loins of a man, so have I caused to cling to me the whole house of Israel and the whole house of Judah, says Yahweh, that they might be to me for a people and for a name and for a praise and for a glory, but they would not hear. And here's the exclusivity of the Bible again, you know, in page after page after page. Without question, the Old Testament is exclusive to this seed line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and no other people. And, of course, that's true of the New Testament as well, but the translations have camouflaged that fact to a large degree. Verse 12, therefore you shall speak to them this word, thus says Yahweh Elohim of Israel, every bottle shall be filled with wine, and they shall say to you, do we not certainly know that every bottle shall be filled with wine?
That's like a chicken in every pot, right?
Okay, right.
It's just like remember that saying from the 30s, a chicken in every pot? It was a campaign slogan.
Right.
That's the equivalent.
Right, right. Yeah, we're prosperous and nothing will shake our prosperity. Of course, the American people thought that way up until like 2006, right?
Well, right. And that's exactly what's going on here. They're convinced that because they're prosperous and they're rich of their own accord and just like America today, and that nothing can knock them down.
Yes, and we're finding out otherwise, aren't we? Verse 13. Then shall you say to them, thus says Yahweh, behold, I will fill all the inhabitants of this land, even the kings that sit upon David's throne, and the priests and the prophets and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with drunkenness. And I will dash them one against another, even the fathers and the sons together, says Yahweh. I will not pity nor spare nor have mercy, but destroy them.
Now brother against brother is very often a result of disobedience and a promise of disobedience or a guarantee of our punishment in disobedience throughout the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. We had civil war down through the millennia, really. Civil war down through the millennia. But our people not knowing that the various European, American, Australian nation states, etc., are the true Israelites, we don't realize that it's internecine brother or brother against brother. Verse 15. Hear you and give ear, be not proud, for Yahweh has spoken. Give glory to Yahweh your Elohim before he caused darkness, and before your feet stumble upon the dark mountains, and while you look for light, he turn it into the shadow of death and make it gross darkness. But if you will not hear, my soul shall weep in secret places for your pride, and my eyes shall weep sore and run down with tears, because Yahweh's flock is carried away captive. Now, here, I just have to comment on verse 17 here, and it's true throughout the scriptures, both old and new, that Yahweh is an anthropomorphic God in the sense that he has feelings, he has emotions. He is the one who gives us life. He is the one who we partake of his, let's say, personalities, so that we have a personality And he is an angry God.
Well, he laughs and cries. He exhibits anger. He exhibits honesty and allegiance. He exhibits even dishonesty. I mean, there was one time where he told, that there's three occasions in the Old Testament where he told people to lie. Of course he's human. He's in the sense that he has all of the emotions that humans understand.
Right.
And he's the author of those emotions.
That's
he's got
right.
It.
He's the author of those emotions.
So he has to have and understand them in order to
right.
have been the author.
Yeah, and he's not this, how should I put it, stoic God that has no feelings or emotions. You know, those feelings and emotions are derived from his personality. He is the author of all those things, okay? So just, and we have, like, for example, Buddhism, and there's other sects that feel that the God is some sort of emotionless creature, you know? But that's
well,
not,
they're all going to be converted, too.
Yeah, right.
Well, right along with the Jews.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So this anthropomorphic God obviously is this God of ours. He feels like a father, like a human father. He feels exactly the same way. And that's what these descriptions are. And he's getting angry at us because we're a rebellious children of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And then he loves us when we obey him. And it's very simple. You know, he has feelings. Unlike a lot of theologians who don't want to admit that he has feelings. Verse 18. Say to the king and to the queen, humble yourselves, sit down, for your principality shall come down, even the crown of your glory. The cities of the south shall be shut up, and none shall open them. Judah shall be carried away captive, all of it. It shall be wholly carried away captive. Lift up your eyes and behold them that come from the north. Where is the flock that was given you, your beautiful flock? What will you say when he shall punish you? For you have taught them to be captains, and as chief over you, shall not sorrows take you as a woman in travail? Okay, what's he saying? For you have taught them to be captains. Is he talking about outsiders here, or simply the rebellious ones?
It's hard to tell. I think he's only talking about the rebellious ones. He's talking to the remnant in general, and the culture created its leaders, right?
Yes.
That's the way I read this.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And of course, well, the same thing is true today. We have the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, traitors all, right, that are undermining the U.S. Constitution and the Bible as we speak.
Well, right. But it's our sinful culture that has followed the Antichrist.
Right.
We have
followed
the Jews into perdition. Yes. And that has allowed this media conglomerate to create these leaders.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, it's the rebelliousness of our whole house, you know, the majority of our people, Israel, that have spawned all this treachery and debased our culture. The Christians have been sitting by. White Christians have been sitting by, watching this happen, doing absolutely nothing about it.
Well, and most of them still participate in the voting process and go vote for one devil or another.
Yeah, right. We vote for devils and we get devils, right.
And they vote based on all the information they get from the Jews.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That they get through the media.
Yeah.
That they read USA Today and they watch CNN and they think they know something.
Right.
They think they can make informed decisions based on what boils down to nothing but the propaganda of the devil.
Right. And all they're doing is thinking Jewish thoughts. The Jews, through their media, have told us what to think, how to think, and when to think it, right? It's superb. And we really have to admire how they have totally taken over our culture. Verse 22, and if you say in your heart, why come these things upon me? For the greatness of your iniquity are your skirts discovered and your heels made bare. Talking about nakedness. Talking about nakedness, the Canaanite rituals where our children, our people, Israel,
Well, we'll definitely see that in the next paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. We're having sex rituals with the Canaanites. Verse 23, can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard its spots? Then may you also do good that are accustomed to evil.
Now there's a huge error in this verse.
Okay.
James, right? Because it doesn't follow that it's a rhetorical question. Can the Ethiopian change his skin? Of course he can't. And the King James and the NAS, the New North American Standard Bible, that they both miss the rhetorical point of verse 23 in their translation.
Okay.
The Septuagint has this: if the Ethiopian shall change his skin or the leopard her spots, then shall you be able to do good, having learnt evil.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the Ethiopian, and Ethiopia by this time was already heavily race mixed and overrun with Nubians.
Right.
Right. It wasn't the white Ethiopia that I talk about of ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremiah is really fairly recent, and Egypt has by this time already had black pharaohs.
Right.
By the time Jeremiah, 100 years before Jeremiah, Egypt had black pharaohs for 50 years.
Okay.
They got rid of the black pharaohs, but they never got rid of the black blood.
Right.
All right.
Exactly.
But, well, of course, the Ethiopian cannot change his skin. The leopard cannot change his spots, and therefore the remnant of Judah who were so accustomed to sinning cannot cease from it. The King James should have read the entire verse as a set of rhetorical questions.
Okay, right.
It should have been two rhetorical questions. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard his spots? And then another question, can you also do good who are accustomed to do evil?
Yeah.
Of course not.
Yeah. And so... Well, either way, the logic of the argument is that, well, obviously, since you can't change the skin and can't change the spots, neither can those who are accustomed do evil. Okay? So their evil ways have become...
Well, right. They've grown up in a evil culture,
yes.
And they just can't change.
That reflects
a lot of our people today.
That's right.
It's a very hard thing to reject everything that you've been taught from your youth and to understand that, yes, the law of God counts. Yes, I better follow it. Yes, I better not be a race mixer. Yes, I better not be a homosexual. I can't even accept homosexuals. You know, Paul says not only those that do these things, but those who approve of them should suffer the judgment of the law.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Verse 24, therefore will I scatter them as the stubble that passes away by the wind of the wilderness. This is your lot, the portion of your measures from me, says Yahweh, because you have forgotten me and trusted in falsehood. Well, is that true today or what? Verse 26, therefore will I discover your skirts upon your face, that your shame may appear. Verse 27, I have seen your adulteries and your neighings and the lewdness of your whoredom and your abominations on the hills and the fields. Woe to you, O Jerusalem! Will you not be made clean? When shall it once be? Well, obviously...
Now, just...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just like Adam and Eve, the covering of the loins, the wearing of the girdle, the whole allegory about the girdle is associated with their sin and their need for shame and to cover it up, right?
Right, right.
The lewdness of my whoredom.
Right, and there's no shame unless you uncover your genitals, right? We're talking about sexual sin here, and we know, and every Judeo-Christian should know, but they don't know because their pastors aren't telling them this, that what the main sin here was frolicking in the groves, having sex with Canaanites.
Well, right, that's... having sex with Canaanites, the people of other races,
yes.
The people of a race odious to Yahweh.
That's right.
I mean, Yahweh said he would make war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
Canaan was cursed forever.
Yes.
And here these people have taken the Canaanites, and instead of destroying them back in the book of Joshua, they thought it more convenient to have them for slaves.
Right.
They were never told to enslave them. They were told to destroy them.
That's right.
And Yahweh, you know, he overlooked, or he didn't overlook it, but he permitted, his permissive will allowed them to continue, knowing that they would it would lead to this error, and they were told in the law that if you allow these people to dwell among you, they will bring you over to their ways.
That's right.
And we see that today with the American Negro, and we see a whole generation of white children now that act, think, and look like Negroes.
That's right. Yeah, and or Mexicans, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they all want to be gangster rappers. It's absolutely insane. It's the destruction of a civilization.
Yeah,
we
want to
the
be
same
stupid.
Thing.
Yeah.
3,000 years ago with ancient Israel and ancient Judah and the Canaanites. It's the same thing all over again, and they started intermingling with these people. That's how the holy flesh passed from a lot of these people, as we read in chapter 11 here. That's how Judah was planted a pleasant plant and grew up to be a strange vine, an alien vine.
Right.
It's race mixing. That's how they became broken cisterns that can't contain the spirit of Yahweh.
Right, yeah. Whenever we get around to Ezra and Nehemiah, we'll find out that the ruling classes were always the worst offenders in this area. Obviously, your farming class, you know, and your shopkeepers and things like that, those people aren't inclined to go a-whoring because they don't have the spare time to do that, right? But the ruling classes do, and they engage in that much more than the common folk. Okay.
Right, and it's clear, there's some banner in the chat. It's very clear from Scripture that all Canaanites are doomed. Zechariah 14:21, the day is coming when there will not be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord, in the house of Yahweh, period. No Canaanites, they're gone. All the Jews and all the descendants of the Canaanites are going to be converted in the last days.
That's right.
Thus is the parable of the wheat and the tares says they're going to be converted to ashes.
That's right. Very good. Very good. Chapter 14, verse 1. The word of Yahweh that came to Jeremiah concerning the dearth or drought. Judah mourns and the gates thereof languish. They are black to the ground and the cry of Jerusalem has gone up. So what's this black to the ground? Does it mean they're just they're sinful? Obviously, it's not talking about
color.
Well,
yes, it's sinful. It's you know, you've disgraced yourself.
Right. So they're black compared to the ground.
Well, yes, it could. Yeah, you know, here it's associated with mourning, which means depression. Yeah, you know, we wear black when we mourn, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did back then too. And it's even written. I think it's in Polybius. I could be wrong. It's in one of the Greek historians, I think it was Polybius, who talked about how the Carthaginians hung black cloth out when evil things happened, when they suffered. That habit of black, associating black with mourning, is 4,000, 5,000 years old at least.
Yeah, very good.
Our people.
Sure. Sure. Excellent. Okay, verse 3. And their nobles have sent their little ones to the waters. They came to the pits and found no water. They returned with their vessels empty. They were ashamed and confounded and covered their heads.
Now let me say that Judah isn't black yet. Jeremiah is a prophet. He's writing these things in advance for a lamentation, for the mourning of what judgment Yahweh is going to bring on Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good. Verse 4. Because the ground is chapped, for there was no rain in the earth. The plowmen were ashamed. They covered their heads. Yea, the hind also calved in the field and forsook it, because there was no grass. And the wild asses did stand in the high places. They snuffed up the wind like dragons. Their eyes did fail, because there was no grass. Of course, this is also metaphorical, because there was no law, and there was no love between the Judahites one for another. Verse 7, O Yahweh, though our iniquities testify against us, do you it for your name's sake, for our backslidings are many. We have sinned against you. O the hope of Israel, the Savior thereof in time of trouble, why should you be as a stranger in the land and as a wayfaring man that turns aside to tarry for a night? Why should you be as a man astonished, as a mighty man that cannot save? Yet you, O Yahweh, are in the midst of us. And we are called by your name. Leave us not.
Well, what this is a dialogue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh passes a judgment, and Jeremiah makes a prayer on behalf of Judah.
Right.
And a lot of this is lost in the translation.
Mm-hmm.
But this method of dialogue, okay, is found, it is esteemed by everybody to be Greek. Well, the Greeks got it from the Hebrews.
Right.
The Greeks got it right from the Hebrew prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, yeah, you know, like the Socratic dialogues is one distinguished example of this. It's a Socratic dialogue. It's a dialogue 300 years before Socrates, right?
Yeah.
It came from the Hebrews. The Greeks got their learning and their literature from the Hebrews because many of them were Hebrews.
That's right.
They were Israelites. It's the same culture. And here we have a dialogue. Yahweh passes a judgment. Jeremiah responds with a prayer on behalf of Israel.
Very good. All right, verse 10. Thus says Yahweh to his people, to this people, thus have they loved to wander. They have not refrained their feet. Therefore, Yahweh does not accept them. Of course, they have wandered away from the law. He will now remember their iniquity and visit their sins. Then said Yahweh to me, pray not for this people for their good.
There's no recourse. There's no entrance to for sinners.
Yes.
Sinners can't pray. You can't pray on behalf of a sinner. You might pray that he repent, but
right.
That's about it. Don't pray for the prosperity or the healing of a sinner, because if he's a sinner, he's undergoing the judgment of Yahweh, and he can't even pray for himself.
Yeah, this verse is clearly saying that these people who he's about to judge are just too far gone. And they
right.
Can't
be and well, exactly. We're going to see that. We're going to see that again later, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, they are too far gone.
Yes. Okay.
Even though he offered them repentance, they refuse it.
Right.
And he knows that, and they're far past the point of repenting.
Yes. Okay.
And if you want to see people past the point of repenting, just go to Greenwich Village.
Yeah, right. Just go to any city where there's Jews.
Right.
Christians, so-called Christians associating with Jews. Verse 12, when they fast, I will not hear their cry. And when they offer burnt offering and an oblation, I will not accept them, but I will consume them by the sword and by the famine and by the pestilence. Obviously, they're hypocrites when they claim to be fasting and praying and they're disobeying his laws. Okay? You're a hypocrite when you do that. Verse 13, then said I, ah, Yahweh Elohim, behold, the prophets say to them, you shall not see the sword, neither shall you have famine. But I will give you assured peace in this place. So, and we have the same thing today. We have the pulpit masters.
Well, the televangelists, right?
Yeah.
That's the exact note that
we're
I have here.
We're all saved. Right. We're all saved. All you
but we're
do
all saved, and you can accept the sinners.
Right. Accept the sinners. And, you know, and, well, the judgment, I don't know who the judgment is going to come against, because we're all saved anyway, right? So that teaching just doesn't make any sense.
Well, they teach that the judgment comes against the people that haven't said, I believe in Jesus.
Or they haven't come up for an altar.
That's the magic word. All you have to say is, I believe in Jesus, and you're saved.
Yeah, right. But you don't have to obey his laws, and you can just stand by while the whole world explodes into chaos and do absolutely nothing, okay? These people,
well, if you just say, I believe in Jesus, you could even marry men, and everything would be all right.
That's right. So they had the same type of preachers back then, right? That's what this verse is telling us. Verse 14, then Yahweh said to me, the prophets prophesy lies in my name. I sent them not. Neither have I commanded them, neither spoke to them. They prophesy to you a false vision and divination and a thing of nothing and the deceit of their heart. Verse 15, therefore, thus says Yahweh concerning the prophets that prophesy in my name, and I sent them not, yet they say, sword and famine shall not be in this land. Okay, we're not going to have a World War III. America's not going to be taken over by its enemies. Look around you, folks. By sword and famine shall those prophets be consumed. Oh, I can't wait to see that day. And the people to whom they prophesy shall be cast out in the streets of Jerusalem. Prophetic Jerusalem too, folks. Because of the famine and the sword. And they shall have none to bury them, their wives, nor their sons, nor their daughters, for I will pour their wickedness upon them. Therefore you shall say this word to them, let my eyes run down with tears night and day, and let them not cease. For the virgin daughter of my people is broken with a great breach, with a very grievous blow. If I go
now, the virgin daughter is, of course, the city, right? The city-state here.
Okay.
That he's talking about. It's Jerusalem, where he's called Jerusalem the daughter of my people, and the daughter is always a city or a nation or a subdivision of Israel
right. That
dwells together. That's the daughter of my people.
Right.
Now, Christ made these same allusions in the New Testament, right?
Okay.
He's the same God in the New Testament. He doesn't change. He says that you think you have prophesied in my name and you've done this and healed people in my name. Well, depart from me, you workers of iniquity.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's the people that worship God in pretense and don't obey his laws and love their brethren.
Right.
Rather, they seek to rule over it and control people through false pretentious religion.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and the Christian Zionists today are watching white people go and be slaughtered in foreign wars for the Jews, and they say, amen, amen.
Well, back then, the Christian Zionists at this time were those men that John said wanted to believe Christ,
mm-hmm.
but they esteemed that the rewards of this world more than the rewards of God.
That's right. That's right.
And that's the most, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That describes most white Christians today.
Yeah, it is. It exactly is. Absolutely. And they think they're saved. Well, I think Yahweh's got news for them. Verse 18. If I go forth into the field, then behold the slain with the sword. And if I enter into the city, then behold them that are sick with famine. Yea, both the prophet and the priest go about into a land that they know not. They're clueless. The modern-day Judeo-Christians are clueless. Verse 19.
Yeah, well, today they do. They go to Kenya. They go to Korea. They go to all these foreign countries looking for proselytes to make them twice the children of hell.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was a Christian missionary that brought Obama back from Kenya, right?
I wouldn't doubt it either.
All right. Verse 19. Have you utterly rejected Judah? Has your soul loathed Zion? Why have you smitten us, and there is no healing for us? We look for our peace, and there is no good. And for the time of healing, behold, trouble. We're going through exactly these things today, folks. Verse 20. We acknowledge, O Yahweh, our wickedness. Well, they're not, today's Judeo-Christians do not acknowledge their wickedness.
Well, this is Jeremiah again.
Yes.
Who is offering a prayer of repentance, and I believe that this is to reflect what Judah and their attitude should have been, right? That this is reflecting what their attitude should have been, and it wasn't, because he's telling us that they wouldn't repent.
Yes.
But all through this chapter, Jeremiah set up, Yahweh set up through Jeremiah,
mm-hmm.
that this basic Socratic dialogue between what should be a theoretically repentant
right.
Judah and Yahweh and Jeremiah is making these words in Judah's mouth, but they don't really reflect the attitude of Judah.
Right.
But even if they did, it's too late. I mean, the nation's been judged.
Right. Well, Jeremiah is doing his best to argue on behalf of Judah, but it ain't working. It's not working. Verse 21, do not abhor us for your name's sake. Do not disgrace the throne of your glory. Remember, break not your covenant with us. Well, of course, if we break our covenant with him, what choice does he have? Verse 20.
Well, we have no right to a covenant if we break break our end of the bargain.
That's right. Absolutely. Verse 22. Are there any among the vanities of the nations that can cause rain, or can the heavens give showers? Are not you he, O Yahweh, our Elohim? Therefore, we will wait upon you, for you have made all these things. So he's appealing to Yahweh on behalf of Judah. He's doing his best to do that. Okay, chapter 15, verse 1. Then said Yahweh to me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be toward this people. Cast them out of my sight and let them go forth. And it shall come to pass, if they say to you, where shall we go forth? Then you shall tell them, thus says Yahweh, such as are for death to death, and such as are for the sword to the sword, and such as are for the famine to the famine, and such as are for the captivity to the captivity. So he's already predetermined who's going to die, who's going to get wounded, who's going to be taken captive, right?
Well, right, and this city's already been judged.
Yeah.
I mean, well, this is how Revelation 13:10 should read, right? And,
okay.
And it does in my translation. If one is for captivity, into captivity he goes. If one is to be slain by the sword, he is to be slain by the sword. Thus is the patience and the faith of the saints.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking about predestination.
Right.
And Revelation 13, of course, is in a different context
right.
than this, but it's the same type of It's the same type of teaching of Scripture. Yes. Yahweh is talking about predestination.
Yes.
Although we choose for ourselves whether or not to be obedient to the call of our God, he's God, so he already knows our choice
right.
and our destiny.
Yeah, it's still about just punishments, because he doesn't punish anyone who isn't wicked, right?
well, right, but just because Esau was chosen from the womb to be a race mixer.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh hated Esau from the womb because he was a race mixer.
Yes.
And Paul,
he knew he was going to be. Yeah.
Well, right. He, exactly. Being God, he just couldn't help but know that Esau was going to be a race mixer.
Exactly.
But the race mixing was Esau's choice.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Verse 3. And I will appoint over them four kinds, says Yahweh, the sword to slay, and the dogs to tear, and the fowls of the heaven, and the beasts of the earth to devour and destroy. And I will cause them to be removed into all kingdoms of the earth because of Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, king of Judah, for that which he did in Jerusalem.
Now let's talk about this, because this is how early Yahweh made up his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how early it was cemented, right?
Right.
The fate of Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles chapter 33 is the story of Manasseh, and he was the king, and then Amon, before Jeremiah began prophesying in the reign of Hosea, right? So Josiah. So we see that the sins of the remnant of Judah assured its fate long before Jeremiah's time even.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Manasseh was two kings before Josiah. Jeremiah tells us explicitly he starts prophesying in the reign of Josiah.
Mm-hmm.
627 B.C. Manasseh was 650-something B.C. So we see that that's how long this is. Yahweh's mind's been long made up, right?
Right.
That's basically what he's telling us here.
Yes, yes. Okay, very good. For who shall have pity upon you, O Jerusalem, or who shall bemoan you, or who shall go aside to ask how you do? You have forsaken me, says Yahweh. You are gone backward. Therefore will I stretch out my hand against you and destroy you. I am weary with repenting. Of course,
well,
this false
repenting is never sincere, right?
Right.
It's always false.
Right. Very, very good. Verse 7. And I will fan them with a fan in the gates of the land. I will bereave them of children. I will destroy my people, since they return not from their ways. Their widows are increased to me above the sand of the seas. I have brought upon them against the mother of the young men a spoiler at noonday. I have caused him to fall upon it suddenly, and terrors upon the city. She that has borne seven languishes, she has given up the ghost. Her son is gone down while it was yet day. She has been ashamed and confounded. And the residue of them will I deliver to the sword before their enemies, says Yahweh. Woe is me. Again, now we're talking Jeremiah. Woe is me, my mother, that you have borne me a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. I have neither lent on usury, nor men have lent to me on usury, yet every one of them does curse me.
Well, right, that's Jeremiah talking. And here we see that usury for both the lender and the borrower is a curse both to men and before God.
Right, right.
Yet it's the way of the Jew, right?
That's right.
I mean, these people aren't Jews.
Yeah.
If these people were Jews, this would have been a banking book.
Yeah.
It would never say anything bad again about usury.
Right, and if we condemn our own people for engaging in usury, what are they going to do? They're going to curse us out, right?
Well, absolutely, right.
Right.
Just like any of the other crimes they're engaging
in. Yeah, they're going to hate us for it. Yes, verse 11. Yahweh said, verily it shall be well with your remnant. Verily I will cause the enemy to entreat you well in the time of evil and in the time of affliction. Shall iron break the northern iron and the steel? Your substance and your treasures will I give to the spoil without price, and that for all your sins, even in all your borders. And I will make you to pass with your enemies into a land which you know not, and for a fire is kindled in my anger, which shall burn upon you. So here is the direct prophecy that they will be taken away to Babylon.
Well, right. And let me say a couple of things to address clowns like Russell LaForge, right?
Okay.
They're a remnant, right?
Yeah.
So if they are a remnant of Judah, and we saw that most of Judah was taken away long ago by the Assyrians.
Right.
Right. And this is a remnant of Judah. And if they're a remnant, then they have to be of pure Judah blood.
That's right.
They can't be Canaanites.
That's right.
Because they're otherwise, why would they be a remnant?
Yeah.
That makes no sense at all.
Yeah, yeah. If they weren't pure-blooded, he wouldn't be concerned about the remnant, right?
Exactly. Now here we see in verse 13, thy substance and thy treasures will I give to the spoil without price. In other words, it's just going to be taken from you.
Right.
And that for all thy sins,
mm-hmm.
even in all thy borders. In other words, even in their own land, right?
Mm-hmm.
Loss of possessions is a result of sin.
Sure.
And I would say that probably includes economies and jobs and manufacturing bases also, right? That's a result of sin, the sin of this nation.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Okay, very good. Verse 15, O Yahweh, you know, remember me and visit me and revenge me of my persecutors. Take me not away in your long suffering. Know that for your sake I have suffered rebuke. And we can say that Jeremiah is speaking for us today. Verse 16, your words were found, and I did eat them, and your word was to me the joy and rejoicing of my heart, for I am called by your name, O Yahweh of hosts. He is speaking for us. Verse
17. Well, right, and the let me just interject that this dialogue is still continuing, and this is another prayer from Jeremiah on behalf of Judah in response to Judah's chastisement.
Yes, yes. Verse 17, I sat not in the assembly of the mockers, nor rejoiced. I sat alone because of your hand, for you have filled me with indignation. And I would say this sentiment is true for almost everyone I've met in Christian identity, that they've gone through periods in their lives when they felt they were all alone because everyone around them was mocking them for their belief, right? And they really had no friends anywhere.
That's exactly right. However, and we've seen this in Ezekiel and Isaiah, that even though you yourself may be a just and righteous man, you're going to suffer for the fate of the sinners around you that
right.
you have to dwell in.
That's right. That's right. And you have to do
that's
your
why,
best.
That, yeah. That's why Yahweh pulled Lot and his family out of Sodom, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, right. And so we have to be spiritually strong, morally strong, and not succumb to all of that, nihilism, and demoralization that's going on all around us. We can't succumb to that. Verse 13.
I'm sorry, one more thought. Paul had told us that even Lot was tormenting his own soul
mm-hmm.
by dwelling amongst those sinners.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we can't stay among them. We come out of Babylon. We're told to come out from amongst them. Or if we have the power and we have a strong community, then we're supposed to put those wrongdoers, those evildoers, out of our communities. And, of course, Judeo-Christians never think in such terms. Verse 18. Why is my pain perpetual and my wound incurable, which refuses to be healed? Will you be altogether to me as a liar and as waters that fail? Of course, Yahweh made us promises, but they were conditional upon our obedience to the law. That's why he removes his blessings from us. Verse 19, therefore, thus says Yahweh, if you return, then will I bring you again, and you shall stand before me, and if you take forth the precious from the vial, you shall be as my mouth. Let them return to you, but return not you to them. In other words,
they can repent and return to the right path, but it's too late for them to be accepted back. Their judgment is the judgment is passed.
Yes, yes.
And it's like being a I was in this position once before, right? I mean, you could be convicted of a crime, and no matter how remorseful you may be, you're going to prison. I mean, it's done. It's a done deal. So Yahweh's telling Jeremiah they can repent and return to the right path, but it's too late for them to be accepted back. They must now face their punishment.
That's right. That's right. Okay, and I will make you to this people a fenced brazen wall, and they shall fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you to save you and to deliver you, says Yahweh. It sounds like he's talking directly to Jeremiah here, because obviously the people had to withstand the Babylonians, and the Babylonians took them. Verse 20.
Well, right. I think he's talking to the righteous of the nation, as Jeremiah was talking in his dialogue on behalf of the righteous of the nation, which included himself. He's using Jeremiah as an example of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Verse
now, 20. Now, we know that Jeremiah ended up in prison because of his prophesying, right? Well,
right.
We'll see later in the
book. Right. Very good. And I will deliver you out of the hand of the wicked, and I will redeem you out of the hand of the terrible. Chapter 16, verse 1. The word of Yahweh came also to me, saying, you shall not take you a wife, neither shall you have sons or daughters in this place. For thus says Yahweh concerning the sons, concerning the daughters that are born in this place, and concerning their mothers that bore them, and concerning their fathers that fathered them in this land. They shall die of grievous death. They shall not be lamented, neither shall they be buried, but they shall be as dung upon the face of the earth, and they shall be consumed by the sword and by famine, and their carcasses shall be meat for the fowls of heaven and for the beasts of the earth. For thus,
let me say,
yes.
I got a few notes here.
Okay.
You know, remember in Paul in 1 Corinthians, and the King James translates it very poorly. He told these people that he advised against their getting married, and he says that it's because of the present violence that he doesn't recommend they get married. And that's because, and what he referred to was, the persecutions of Christians under Claudius and Nero,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there was great violence being perpetrated by the Jews and by the Romans at the instigation of the Jews against Christians. Paul was telling these people not to get married because they were going, if they got married and tried to have families as Christians, they're going to suffer in the flesh or in the faith, one or the other.
Right.
They're
going to watch their children being slaughtered by Roman soldiers too, right?
Well, right. So here Yahweh's saying to Jeremiah, don't get married in this place. And he's telling Jeremiah not to get married in Jerusalem.
Right.
We saw in Jeremiah 1, verse 6, that he was a young man. And he still is a rather young man.
Mm.
And therefore, it was only natural that he should want to seek a wife at this point in his age, right?
Right.
And Yahweh's telling him, put those thoughts away, because if you get married, you're just going to have problems. You're going
right.
to lose your wife. Your kids are going to be killed, and they'll be caught up in that. So Yahweh's telling them, you have to do my will here and not get married.
Right.
But there's not a lot of people try to read more than that into this passage, and that's the context. Yeah, that Jeremiah is a young man and wants to get married. And Yahweh's telling him no, because you're probably going to lose your family.
Right. Very good. Very good. Okay. Verse 5. For thus says Yahweh, enter not into the house of mourning, neither go to lament nor bemoan them, for I have taken away my peace from this people, says Yahweh, even loving kindness and mercies. Both the great and the small shall die in this land. They shall not be buried, neither shall men lament for them, nor cut themselves, nor make themselves bald for them. Now, I know about the ritual of cutting themselves. That was fairly common. That was a Canaanite practice. But what's this ritual of balding themselves?
Shaving the head in mourning was very, and they even did it in the New Testament period. They still did it.
Okay.
They shaved their head in mourning. They shaved their head undertaking the taking of certain vows.
Mm-hmm.
We see that Paul shaved his head before he returned to Jerusalem because Herod had ordered all of the sect of the Nazarenes to shave their heads.
Okay, and that was
and that's something that we have to put together from Josephus, because the Book of Acts doesn't really tell us why Paul had a vow to shave his head.
Okay,
but it was also an act of humiliation. It was an act of humbling yourself. The hair is part of your appearance, yet the beauty of your appearance, and to take it off was an act of humbling yourself in mourning.
Right. Yeah. Well, I understand from the Old Testament when David was mourning, he put on a cloak, and typically in the Old Testament they would tear their cloaks, right? And then, but they would also cover their heads rather than shave them. That's my understanding of the Israelite.
Well, the custom at that time was a little different, but we're already 500 years past that, right?
Right. So they sounds like they had adopted a Canaanite practice. Okay. All right. Very good. Where was I? Okay. Verse 7. Neither shall men tear themselves for them in the morning to comfort them for the dead. What does that mean, tear themselves?
Well, it might be to tear their flesh or their garments.
Okay.
And even in the New Testament, in the Book of Acts, when Paul and Barnabas went, when the people of a certain town claimed that they were gods because they healed the man, they tore their clothes in mourning and said, no. Yeah, you know, and that was a sign of debasing yourself.
Yes.
You know, rather than accepting that these people believe for you to be a god, you're going to debase yourself and in refutation of that proclamation, right? No,
yes.
We're not gods. We're just men like you, and they rent their clothes. And we see a lot of clothes renting in the New Testament.
Right.
And that's a sign of humbling oneself also.
Yes. Yeah, I had to log back in, and I see that Joel wants to discuss a verse. I guess the one that we're just discussing now, God told Jeremiah not to marry.
So well, I just discussed that verse. I have
right.
nothing more to add to that. I mean, why should I ask? You know, I just discussed the verse in context of Jeremiah.
Right.
And if Joel missed it, that's just
well,
not.
Well, I guess he has something to say about it. So let me see. Well, he hasn't called in. So if he calls in, maybe he's got a different take on it. So we'll continue.
I'm sure he does, because Joel's a pretty peculiar individual.
He's a scientist, right? Okay, where was I again? I've been losing my place here. Okay, verse 8. You shall not also go into the house of feasting to sit with them to eat and to drink. For thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will cause to cease out of this place in your eyes and in your days the voice of mirth, and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride. And it shall come to pass, when you shall show this people all these words, and they shall say to you, why has Yahweh pronounced all this great evil against us? Or what is our iniquity? Or what is our sin that we have committed against Yahweh our God? Again, the Judeo-Christians will respond exactly in this manner. What did we do wrong? We love Jesus.
Exactly. And that's the exact note that I have after this verse. Just like our people today, they recognize sin, that they sin and recognize it not.
Yeah.
They sin and recognize it not because they don't know the law.
Yeah. Okay. Joel has called in. Let me recognize him here. Okay. Joel, yes, you do get to speak. Which verse are you going to address? The business about... that Yahweh is not going to take Israel as a wife?
Okay. I can understand fully the way you two gentlemen are interpreting these verses. And
okay.
I see that you're making a very Christian effort to basically find good in every word in the Bible.
Okay.
I can see that you're trying to do that. My point is not that there's bad in the Bible. The point I'm trying to get to is that Jews will interpret certain verses in a way that will justify them doing evil.
Okay.
Now, can I speak?
Yeah,
right,
which verse are we talking about exactly now?
All right, let me give you three examples.
Okay.
The verse 16:2, where it says God told Jeremiah not to marry,
right.
That actually was a slogan of the Jews in the 1960s. There used to be a Jewish actor named Nehemiah Pirsoff, and I saw him one time on television. And he was essentially in a bragging kind of a Kirk Douglas mode.
Okay.
And he was trying to get across this idea that he was in control of Christian America. And he just barked out. He said, Jeremiah! See? Like a drunken animal that he was. And he was based, but his interpretation was basically that the book of Jeremiah was a game plan for Jews to use against Christians to keep Christians in and out of prison and hopping from one scene to the next and never getting married.
Oh,
so,
okay.
In other words, I'm trying to explain
yeah,
what I'm getting at is that the Jew is going to find the dirtiest possible interpretation of every verse in the Bible, and then he uses it on us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not aware of that, then you can get taken in.
All right,
let me
see if I understand what you're saying here. So, in other words, the Jew is saying, well, you're not going to have sons and daughters because we're going to make babies with them, right? Is that what you're saying?
But it works. But it works because the birth rate dropped down to nothing during the 1960s.
Yeah.
Baby boomers didn't have any kids at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was the general attitude that came down through the Frankfurt School and the Jewish infiltration of our culture. But I don't think it was because of that one person.
Well, yeah.
He's
just offering that as
if we want to talk about the Jewish angle on Scripture and everything they pervert, we could probably be here all year with Jeremiah.
Yes.
Okay, now wait.
We have a couple more verses?
Yes, let me give you another one. In the 1980s, just before it became obvious that Woody Allen was a child molester and he was molesting Mia Farrow's children, he did a movie with Mia Farrow called Hannah and Her Sisters. And at one point in the movie, he makes a comment. He says, "Is Saul among the prophets?" But what he was speaking to, see, you can interpret the relationship between Saul and David as a relationship between an old fag and a pedophile. Yes,
right.
Because what happens is Saul becomes mentally ill and David plays the flute or the lyre or something, and then Saul gets better. But see, you can interpret that as the relationship between a fag and his child victim. But
only
that's
you're
what Woody Allen,
Jew.
But see, that's what Woody Allen was saying. He was saying, I can do this to Mia Farrow's kids because it's biblical.
Okay. Yeah, right. That's how they interpret it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let me give you the third example.
Okay.
About 10 years ago, Richard Dreyfuss was on television, and he said, a lamp has to burn without oil for 8 days. But now, 10 years later, we're $14 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's my point. I am not challenging your interpretation
right.
of these verses.
No,
but
I
I'm saying that I think it's imperative to understand that the Jew will pervert these words, and then he will use that. He'll say, I can do this to Christians on the authority of this book.
Right.
See, that's my point. I'm not challenging your interpretation.
No.
Well, right, but Joel, what don't the Jews pervert?
Right.
Well, okay, now
what don't they
I
pervert?
Couldn't.
What word have they perverted in our dictionary to remind the Bible?
Right, yeah, they've perverted everything. Yeah.
And you know,
yeah.
when a Christian listens to a Jew, you could expect the Christian to travel right down the path to hell.
Yeah, and the Jew laughs.
Right. The problem is we shouldn't listen to Jews about anything,
right.
ever.
But Joel, this is Talmudic thinking, and what you're saying is absolutely right, that the Jews, through their Talmudic rabbis, have gotten in the habit of perverting everything to allow them to commit every crime under the sun.
And they do. He's right about that. But
yes.
that doesn't get, you know, that. The verse is clearly interpreted by any Christian who would actually read his Bible
right.
and understand a little about what's going on. I mean, if
yes.
you read the Bible like you do a novel,
yes.
you know,
yes.
people read a novel and read it as one story from beginning to end
right.
and understand it in context. Well, they read their Bible one verse at a time.
Yeah. Well, the common Christian belief is that the Jews have preserved the oracles of God, right? And that's absolute nonsense. They have perverted the oracles of God. You know, that's Joel's point here, correct? That's what you're trying
well,
to bring
absolutely.
up.
Well, absolutely, and they're good elucidations, but like
yeah.
I said,
you
know, no matter how great the elucidations, if we spent, we could look up
right.
everywhere the Jews pervert and spend an hour on each passage just talking about how they interpret it in the Talmud.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
well,
incredible.
Right, yeah. Well, that's good for people to know, though. Yeah. Okay, Joel. Yeah.
And I would. You know, if you really want to know how
you.
The Jews pervert things, thank you, Joel.
Yeah.
If you really want to know how the Jews pervert things, I would go to that Come and Hear site and read Elizabeth Dilling's work on the Talmud.
Right, right, yeah, because it proves how they pervert things. Yeah, yeah, and so, but yeah, if you're a good Jew watcher, you can see what verses, if they reference verses of the Bible, like if you watch a Jew on television and he references a Bible verse, you can tell how he's perverting it. Right.
Well, right. And Yahweh didn't tell Jeremiah not to marry. He told him not to marry in
yeah.
this place.
Right.
Because all these people are going to die. And if you marry one of them and become emotionally attached to one of them, well you're going to suffer for that.
That's right. That's right. Okay, let's continue. Verse chapter 16, verse 5. For thus says Yahweh, enter not into the house of mourning, neither go to lament nor bemoan them, for I have taken away my peace from this people, says Yahweh, even loving kindness and mercies. Both the great and the small shall die in this land. They shall not be buried, neither shall men lament for them, nor cut themselves, nor make themselves bald for them. Neither shall men... Okay, I read these already, sorry. Verse 8, you shall not go also into the house of feasting to sit with them and eat and drink. For thus says Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will cause to cease out of this place in your eyes and in your days the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of bridegroom and the voice of the bride. Okay.
Now that's an injunction in addition to don't get married in this place.
Right.
Don't go into the house of feasting with these people in this place, right?
Yes.
And that helps show the context of the entire, you know, of the entire chapter.
Right. Okay, now I've found my place again. Let me read verse 10 anyway, because I'm not sure if I finished it. And it shall come to pass when you shall show this people all these words, and they shall say to you, why has Yahweh pronounced all this great evil against us? Or what is your iniquity, or what is our sin, or is our iniquity, or our sin that we have committed against Yahweh our God? Then shall you say to them, because your fathers have forsaken me, says Yahweh. Well, how many generations of Judeo-Christians do we have today that have forsaken Yahweh and his law?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We still, you know, they say, I believe in Jesus, but they still forsake his ways.
That's
what
right.
did he say? If you love me, keep my commandments.
That's right. That's right. And have walked after other gods and other religions and have served them and have worshipped them and have forsaken me and have not kept my law. And you have done worse than your fathers. For behold, you walk everyone after the imagination of his evil heart, that they may not hearken to me. Therefore will I cast you out of this land into a land that you know not. Neither you nor your fathers, and there shall you serve other gods day and night, where I will not show you favor.
Right. And I have two comments. First, you know, we're bound to the law even if we're ignorant of it.
Right.
We're bound to it. Our ancestors bound us to this law. And we're going to, as long as we stay ignorant of that fact, we're not going to follow the law, so we're going to continue to suffer the punishment.
That's right.
And we could follow the law by accident, which is what most Americans did in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and we prospered.
Yeah.
But we were still ignorant of why we prospered, because
right.
we didn't understand that we should be obedient to God, and we will have prosperity.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's certainly true of America in the 19th century that Americans were law-abiding Christian people, and that's why America prospered. There's simply no doubt about that.
We became the greatest nation on the face of the earth because of our Christian values, not in spite of them.
That's right.
And now we become the most debased nation on the face of the earth because of Judeo-Christianity,
right.
because we live in a Judaized society, we've forsaken God, we've worshipped all the idols of the Jews, the pornography, the sports, and the movies, and everything else that they've set up in their little idol groves called Hollywood and Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And New York.
Hollywood, yes.
Right, and that's why we've become a debased nation.
That's right.
There's no doubt. Anybody who knows anything about history should be able to see that.
Right.
Now, this last verse, 13, is pretty interesting because it says, you shall serve other gods night and day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when have the Jews ever admitted doing that?
Yeah.
When have the Jews ever admitted practicing paganism?
Right.
And that's because they've never been Israel.
Mm-hmm.
No pagans, no Israel. All of Israel, after they were deported from Palestine, except for those who returned and the ones who stayed close and kept the law, all the other Israelites turned to paganism
mm-hmm.
until the Christian period.
Right, right. Yes, very good. Verse 14, therefore, behold, the days come, says Yahweh, that it shall no more be said, Yahweh lives, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. And, of course, well, the modern Judeo-Christians have forsaken Yahweh and his
Well, right. Nietzsche, they all believe Nietzsche when he said God is dead, right?
Yeah, right.
The truth
right.
is Nietzsche's dead.
Yeah. The lower criticism, yes. Verse 15, but Yahweh lives that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from the lands where he had driven them, and I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers. Behold, I will send for many fishers, says Yahweh, and they shall fish them. Okay, any comment right here?
Well, yes, I do. I have quite a few comments.
Okay.
I'll wait until you finish the verse, but let me speak about the verse 15, that land that I gave unto their fathers. That has to be the Deuteronomy 32:8 land, right? The Deuteronomy 32:8 land where it says that when Yahweh divided the nations, he left it down to the people according to the number of the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that really can never describe the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan, as we see in 2 Samuel 7:10, is a temporary land.
Right.
It's not the permanent land of the children of Israel. And the Deuteronomy 32:8 land can only be northern Europe, where the mm-hmm. other Adamic nations, that
right.
they sojourn there, some of them, but they never built anything lasting north of the Danube.
Right.
Period. They never, the other Adamic nations never had anything lasting until the Scythian Israelites and the Celtic Israelites
right.
moved there, right. and that's 2 Samuel 7:10 that we
right.
would be moved to
that's
a place,
right.
a camp in there. Palestine, from which we would never move again, right?
Right. So in other words, let me try to rephrase what you're saying, because that verse in both Samuel, 2 Samuel 7:10 and Deuteronomy 32:8, is that one, the one you're referencing?
Yes.
Are talking about the fact that even though all of these territories were first occupied by Japheth and also by Israelites who didn't know they were Israel, nevertheless, the nations that formed in those territories were named after Israelites.
Right. They were all Israel.
That's exactly what happened. Yes. Okay. And otherwise, you know, those verses are very difficult to understand what they're referring to. Okay. All right. Verse 16. Behold, I will send for many fishers, says Yahweh, and they shall fish them. And after will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. Okay, so fishers and hunters.
Well, right. This verse is incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
It's Clifton wrote an excellent essay around this verse entitled, Who Are the Hunters?
Okay.
The fisher period was the spread of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
We have long been in the hunter period, searching to discover where Israel went
yeah.
after their deportation.
Okay.
The hunters must be the historians and archaeologists of Christian identity,
right.
since they are the only ones who have sought out Israel.
Right.
Jeremiah 31:34 indicates that the period of the fishers ends,
mm-hmm.
and where it says in relationship to the promise of a new covenant that, quote, they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know Yahweh. For they all shall know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them,
yes.
says Yahweh. For I will forgive their iniquity, I will remember their sin no more. The
right.
apostles were fishers of men, and therefore the period of the fishes represented the spread of the gospel.
Right.
So it ended when all of the Celto-Saxon nations of Israel received the gospel. It
right.
was no longer time for the fishers, but it was a time for transition to the hunters.
Yes.
We are not in the period of fishers. We are the
That's
time
yes.
to tell people about Jesus is long over.
right. Our
it's
people
long,
know about Jesus, don't
all
they?
All these mainstream churches, well, our entire race has heard it.
Yes.
Our entire race knows about the Bible. Our entire race knows about Christ. Our entire race has heard the gospel message.
Yes.
There's
right.
no more time for it. It's a done deal. The period of the fishers is long past.
Yes.
All of these mainstream churches want to grasp on to that period of the fishers
right.
and not let it go.
Yes, and fish,
and
other types of fish, right?
Well, right.
other races,
the wrong kind
of
fish.
Right.
It's all absolute vanity.
Yes.
We are the period of the hunters. What do the hunters do? They look for them in the holes of the rock.
Right. Well, yeah, and that corresponds to the verse where Jesus says, you know, he's going to go and find that lost sheep, wherever
well,
that lost sheep may be.
Exactly. He said that he had sheep in another fold.
Mm-hmm.
He had to find that other fold. That he went for the one sheep. I look at that verse like this. He left the 99 sheep behind in Europe, went for the one in Palestine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, proportionately.
Right.
That's the way I look at that scripture.
Sure.
Ezekiel 34 says, my sheep have wandered over every mountain.
Right.
600 years before Christ, Yahweh knows where they are. He knows where his sheep are. It's our job.
Uh-huh.
Create hunters that find his sheep.
Right.
That's Israel identity.
Yeah. And the only Christian identity is actually doing that, searching out the remnant. That's we're the only ones doing that. Verse 17.
Well, the British archaeologists.
Right. Yeah, well,
from the time Britain, from the time Christian identity was discovered, it wasn't a made-up doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It was discovered when Henry Layard dug up the remains of Nineveh.
Right.
And historians started reading the inscriptions And George Moore wrote the first, you know, he wrote his book, The Saxons of the East and the Saxons of the West and the Lost Tribes in 1860.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a result of British archaeology. It was a result of our science. It wasn't just made up by some quacks in California, as the ADL and the SPLC would like to have you believe.
Sure. Yeah, British and American archaeologists and historians. And again, in the 19th century, they were getting closer and closer and closer to a British Israel type of ideology, okay, understanding that, hey, these Caucasians, they spoke Hebrew. Welsh is a form of Hebrew. Anglo-Saxon is a form of Hebrew. German is a form of Hebrew, okay? And then in the 20th century, all that knowledge got reversed because the Jews took over our institutions.
Well, they took over British Israel.
That's right.
The Jews, Edward Hein was a Jew. He was a Rothschild agent. He was a banker. He started out as a banker. All of a sudden, he became a history agent overnight. Just add water and stir, and you have a history. You have a history expert out of a banker.
Right.
And he wrote that book, and all of a sudden, British Israel turned anti-German. They made themselves whores for the Rothschilds.
That's right. That's right. They sure did.
And it's become nothing but a stodgy old man's club ever since.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't start out that way. It started with all the best scholarship.
That's
Sharon
right.
Turner,
it did start that
George
way.
Moore, and the whole long line of scholars, and Edward Hein and Rothschild money usurped and perverted it.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
And it's still a usurped and perverted the British Israel World Federation and the the Ensign Messenger, they're still usurped and perverted for the most part. Their leadership is. There may be some good members.
They're getting more and more Judaized, yes.
No doubt. Well, you know, I went to the Canadian branch of the British Israel World Federation and found out that their spokesman was Peter Salimi, a Jew.
Or an Arab. I thought he was an Arab.
Well, it doesn't matter. He's a Canaanite.
All right. Okay, an Arab Jew. All right, there we go. Because they teach that the Jews are the tribe of Judah. And, you know, the Jews themselves say 90% of us are Ashkenazi Khazars, none of whose ancestors ever set foot in Palestine. So how in the world can they possibly be Judah? They can't. And they don't teach anything about the Edomites. Becoming Judeans, they don't teach anything about that.
Well, exactly, and that's the role of the hunters too, right? Identify these parties. Identify these people of the Old Testament. We have the data. We have the proof. That we have the historical, irrefutable historical proof.
Yes.
And linguistic proof and biblical proof.
Yes.
And that is the role of the hunter.
Yes, very good, very good. All right, verse 17. For my eyes are upon all their ways. They are not hidden from my face, neither is their iniquity hidden from my eyes. Okay, so he's got his eyes on us, right, all the time, verse 18. And first I will recompense their iniquity and their sin double, because they have defiled my land. They have filled my inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable and abominable things. Does it sound like he's angry? Verse 19. Oh, Yahweh, and here again, Jeremiah responds, Oh, Yahweh, my strength and my fortress and my refuge in the day of affliction, the nations shall come to you from the ends of the earth and shall say, Surely our fathers have inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there is no profit. Well, I think we're beginning to say that. I think we're beginning to realize that. Verse 20.
Well, right. That intones that there's an awakening, right?
Yes.
That people ask that question.
Yes. Very good.
That suddenly we do realize our identity, and in order to ask those, otherwise how could we ask those questions?
That's right. Verse 20, shall a man make gods to himself, and they are no gods? Therefore, behold, I will this once cause them to know. I will cause them to know my hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is Yahweh. Okay, let's continue. I think we can get through the Yahweh enunciated verses here in chapter 17. The red verses in my Bible, some Bibles don't have the differentiation between the red and the black. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with the point of a diamond. It is graven upon the table of their heart and upon the horns of your altars. Until their children remember their altars and their groves by the green trees upon the high hills. We're talking about the shrines, the groves of the Canaanites that our people participated in those days. Verse 3, O my mountain in the field, I will give you substance and all your treasures to the spoil, and your high places for sin throughout all your borders.
Now, when we tell the pagans that their pagan religion is the Canaanite religion of the Old Testament, mm-hmm. they get extremely offended.
That's right.
But it can't be traced back to anywhere else in
That's
the world.
That's right. That's right. All the names of the gods that modern pagans worship come right from here. Come from pagan worship.
Even Odin. Odin is a word that could have had a legitimate use, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it means Lord. Odin is the Hebrew word Adon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it means Lord.
Yeah, yeah. And like Bela is the name Baal, right? And they, all the various Halloween, all the various pagan festivals and gods and goddesses, they all go right back to old Canaan land.
Well, right. The Celtic bell is the
right.
Carthaginian bell, which was the Phoenician bell, which was the
Canaanite bell. Exactly.
Yeah, the Canaanite bell.
Yeah.
And those people weren't Canaanites. It's the religion the Israelites got from the Canaanites.
Right. From Jezebel.
But even before Jezebel, from the time of Rehoboam, when he set up the golden calves.
That's right.
And forbid the northern tribes from going to Jerusalem to the temple.
Right, right. And, you know, so once these modern white pagans realize that what they're actually practicing is a form of ancient Judaism, then they get offended, right?
Well, they should be offended by that.
You
know, the modern pagans accuse Christian identity people of adopting Jewish religion.
Yeah.
They didn't adopt the Jewish religion because the Jews were never, the religion of the Old Testament was never their religion.
Right. Never was.
We've adopted the Israelite Hebrew religion that our fathers originally had. They have adopted the Jewish religion.
That's right.
Because the Jews, are the Canaanites of the Old Testament.
That's right.
And the pagans are their whores.
Right, right. And actually, so the joke's on modern pagans. They don't realize they're actually practicing Judaism under the various names of Bel and, I can't really think of the other gods that the Canaanites worship, but those are all pagan Canaanite gods. Simply no doubt about it. Okay, verse 4. And you, even yourself, shall discontinue from your heritage that I gave you, and I will cause you to serve your enemies in the land which you know not, for you have kindled a fire in my anger which shall burn forever. Thus says Yahweh, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from Yahweh. For he shall be like the heath in the desert. What's heath? Do you have any idea what that word is?
I'll look it up.
Heath in the desert. It doesn't say heap. It's H-E-A-T-H. And shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness in a salt land and not inhabit it. And I think we discussed that there, an invading army wanted to really punish a people, they would put salt on their farmland so they couldn't grow anything.
Well, the Romans sowed Carthage with salt, and nothing grew for 100 years.
Yeah.
They sowed the land when they defeated the Carthaginians in the Second Punic War.
Mm-hmm.
They sowed the land of Carthage with salt,
mm-hmm.
and nothing grew for 100 years.
Yeah.
And then they went back and settled it themselves and colonized it, right?
Right.
Heath in the desert, the word heath is apparently arar. It's an adjective. It means stripped, destitute, or bare.
Okay, bare desert. Okay. So they translate it as a noun here, which it shouldn't be translated as a noun. Okay.
Evidently.
Yes. Verse 7, blessed is the man that trusts in Yahweh and whose hope Yahweh is, for he shall be as a tree planted by the waters and that spreads out her roots by the river and shall not see when heat comes, but her leaf shall be green and shall not be careful in the year of the drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. In other words, go ahead.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, it says, in other words, the people can't see the drought coming when all the signs are there.
And this is the this tree, the man who trusts in Yahweh and this tree planted by the waters that never ceases to bear fruit,
mm-hmm.
is the exact vision we see in Revelation chapter 22 and the culmination of the age.
Right, right. So, in other words, those people of his who are true and faithful, they will proceed to have water. and will proceed to live. Whereas those who have given up and actually worshiped other gods, you know, like American Idol, they will be destroyed. They will be destroyed. Verse 9, just like the children of Judah here in Jeremiah's time. It's going to be a repeat of history. The judgment day is going to be a planetary-wide judgment of Israel. And Peter says, judgment begins at our house first. Verse 9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, Yahweh, search the heart. I try the reins or the guts. to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. It's justice, folks. Verse 11, as a partridge sits on eggs and hatches them not, so he that gets riches and not by right shall leave them in the midst of his days, and at his end shall be a fool. So let's conclude on that verse. I think it's worth some discussion here, because the partridge, I guess, is one of those birds, like the cuckoo bird, that I think it's the cuckoo bird that places its eggs in the nest of another bird and just throws out the eggs of the indigenous bird. And so the other bird brings up the cuckoo's young, right? So isn't that what we're doing today? Aren't we Americans raising blacks and Mexicans and Jews in our midst? And they're destroying us?
Well, yeah, I guess that could be equated to the action of the cuckoo bird.
Uh-huh, yeah. So the partridge must be one of those birds that the cuckoo bird does this to, okay? So our people are being fooled by the cuckoo bird, a cuckoo Jew, right, who has substituted his own seed line in place of ours, and we don't recognize that he's a parasite. That the parasitic bird has taken over our society, and every parasite always manipulates the host so that the host feeds the parasite. That's what we're doing.
We will see that there's every opportunity to do that in Jerusalem at this time. Mm-hmm. When we get to, I think it's Jeremiah chapter 24, and the parable of the good and the bad figs, and there we will see the true nature of sin in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay,
but the error belongs to us.
Yes.
But when we end up with a society like we have, it's because we believe the devil.
Yeah, yeah.
When the Jews came into this land and started telling us how our society had to be changed and started trying to assert control over it from the media that they purchased, we bought the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
We bought the televisions. We bought the radios.
Yeah.
From one end of the dial to the other end of the dial, it was owned by the Jews, and it was controlled by their rhetoric,
right,
and their political agenda,
yeah,
and we bought it all.
That's
so,
how
so
a parasite
the
works. The parasite winds up, you know, if we have an internal parasite, say a yeast infection, you know, it thrives on sugar, right? So it gives us an appetite for more sugar, right? The Jew is in our guts. And teaches lies, right? And it gives us an appetite for more lies. It feeds us on lies, okay? It's a parasitic entity. Okay, very good. This verse 11, maybe we can pick up with this and maybe talk a little bit more about parasites and how parasites have infested Anglo-Saxon countries throughout history, right? And so we'll leave it at this point. Good job today, Bill, this is a very, very enlightening few chapters of the book of Jeremiah. Thanks for helping me shed light on these passages, and looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night about Revelation, and also we'll come back to Jeremiah next Friday. So in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for listening. Praise Yahweh, and Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.